Welcome to GeoTalk, the podcast for geocaches down under. In this episode of GeoTalk, Bear Left chats with Rabideau from Victoria, Bronze tells us all about an earth-shattering event in western New South Wales, and I talk with Brian from Groundspeak about the Unite for Diabetes campaign. All this and more on GeoTalk. Welcome to 2007, and with it, the fifth episode of GeoTalk. I hope you enjoyed your festive activities as much as I did. I spent a very cold Christmas down in Melbourne. Not unusual for the southern capital, but anyway, I thoroughly enjoyed my time. And one of the things I really did enjoy travelling down from Sydney were the number of caches that were along the Hume Highway. And anyone who travels along that highway, you should use those caches as part of your revive-survive strategy, because it is really a great opportunity to stretch your legs and get out of the car. One of the other things that I enjoyed over the last week was spending New Year's Eve on Sydney Harbour. It was my first time that I've done it, and watched spectacular fireworks, which helped see in the new year in a really big way. And it was really enjoyable, very friendly atmosphere, and a really good time. And I'll give you a link to some video and pictures that I took of the fireworks from New Year's Eve. If you've got any photos that you've taken of New Year's Eve in your area, send them in, and we'll include a link to them in the next show. One of the things that I've found quite interesting is the number of geocaching New Year resolutions that have been posted on the Geocaching Australia forums. If you haven't seen those, check them out. Go to forum.geocaching.com.au and see what people have decided they're going to do in 2007. My personal target is to go from 600 to 750 caches. It's a fairly, you know, easy ask, I suppose, but it requires a little bit of dedication. I'm also hoping to get to the Northern Territory this year and add that to my list of states and territories that I found caches in. The Unite for Diabetes Travel Bug campaign has begun, and there's a lot of conversation on the forums, both on the Geocaching and Geocaching Australia forums. Brian Roth from Groundspeak, the coordinator of the program, has been kind enough to spend some time chatting with me about this campaign, and you'll hear his interview a little bit later on in this episode. But before we get into the Geocacher profile, it's time for the GeoTalk quiz question. And the question's fairly simple. Which cache had the most number of finds logged according to the Geocaching Australia website for 2006? And a bonus point if you can tell me which state it was in. See how you go. In March 2005, Team Rabideau from Victoria found 56 caches in one day, setting a new Australian record. Now, since then, the record has been broken and stands at 102. But as part of Geocacher Profile, we thought we'd rewind back to an interview that Papa Bear Left did with Team Rabideau to find out about how he planned finding that massive number of caches.
So I'm sure it seemed like a good idea at the time to go and spend 19 hours of a day getting up pre-dawn and going off and finding as many caches as possible. Whose idea was it to begin with?
Well, it basically came from the GCA forum, the Geocaching Australia forum, where somebody had asked the question, and nobody really seemed to know. And Tim P had put on the website that they believed they had about 30 plus. They weren't really definitive because they couldn't remember exactly how many it was, and we gave it a crack at that time and pulled 33 out of a hat with not too much there, but we still had to put in a full day. But once that number was on the board, everyone wanted to have a crack at it, and it soon fell not once but twice. It went to 43, and about a month after that, it went to 44.
I gather a lot of planning is really the key to success here.
That's right. You really do need to plan and have everything down. We waited until we had about a choice of probably about 70 odd caches within the area between, as I say, Port Melbourne and Berwick, between that line. So we had a distance of probably about 40 kilometres long by about 10 kilometres wide. We had, as I say, about 70, and gradually tried to pick out the ones that really weren't doable. And before we started, we probably picked about half a dozen out of that really weren't going to be done. We picked the Moomba weekend, which is a fairly big weekend. weekend, and that struck about four of them out straight away. The other thing we need to be very aware of is that some of them were very high-profile places, and so the route had to be very carefully planned. In as much as the caches that were going to be in the heart of the gap, in the heart of the replaced areas, were going to be taken early in the morning or late at night.
Mm-hmm.
Hence starting around St Kilda, and probably knocking out about a dozen of the St Kilda caches before the sun sort of really got too high in the sky.
Just to go back a bit, who was actually on the team? Who was involved in the cache getting?
Okay, we took three of them. We're Rabbitohs a six-member family, mum, dad, and four kids. For the day, we took the three most sort of able members because he really had to keep going and that for the whole time. So is myself, the dad, my oldest son Simon, who is 20, and my next oldest son, who is Hadley, who is 15. So the three of us there. So we headed out. We're probably about 30 kilometres to our, well, probably about 20 to our start point, mm-hmm. and we were going to pick up one Māori cache on the way, which was a did not find. That was a great start.
Oh yes, that must have been demoralising.
Yeah, so it was a bit off the route where we were coming through, but we thought we'd pick it up on the way getting towards where we were going.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the last did not find for probably 17 hours, I think, till the next one.
Did you have a predefined cut-off point where you were going to pull the plug on a given cache?
No, we had another. I think about eight caches that we could do going out there, and then we would have been out of caches. But we ran out of time before we ran out of caches. So mm-hmm. we pulled the pin at midnight, and that was the end.
And so as the day wore on, you sort of moved along your cache corridor.
Yes, we did. We had about 24 already under the belt by the first 6 hours, which was great. But the next area where we had only about a dozen caches in probably about a 20 kilometre by 10 kilometre area.
Mm, so a bit of driving as well as caching.
Yeah. So there was a fair bit of driving in between, and some fairly busy areas coming through as far as traffic goes.
Right. So you were on track.
On track, yeah. So we 44 was the target, was the first target to equal,
mm-hmm.
45 for the record. Then we wanted to do 50, and then we were just going to go after that to see what we could come up with.
And I guess an important part of the preparation is to read other people's logs.
Yes, yes. So you don't want to try going around a fair few first to find.
Mm-hmm.
I think that can be very, very dangerous. I feel we're fairly canny on sussing people out, going to an area. And in the early stage when we were caching, you would go down, you'd start searching under every rock or every mm-hmm. tree branch or everything like that. And
yeah.
Now we'll go to an area, we'll just stand and look around, and we won't even pick up anything
mm-hmm.
until you've sort of seen, okay, that's an area where somebody would put something, and you can mm-hmm. usually pick them.
Are there plans to either defend or break your own record?
Well, after we did it, we said no, that now we've got that, we'll probably just set that and let it go. But now you sort of look at it and you think, I wonder what you can do. You start looking at that 6 hours that we didn't spend early on in the day, or 5 hours before we got up, and
all that time you wasted asleep.
Yes, that's right. It's time I wasted, and I sort of got another little bit of a kick on the weekend to think somebody around Dubbo actually came within one and didn't do it. They actually helped another cacher out who had broken, or not broken down, but got themselves wedged over a stump and lost an hour during the day.
Right.
And if they hadn't had that, they would have the record.
And of course, the other thing is, I'm sure, having spent 19 hours finding the things, how long did you spend logging them?
Yes, that was all Sunday. that was a very peaceful day, logging all day, coming back, doing a dozen or so, and then going away again and coming back and doing another dozen.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm joined by Bronze from central New South Wales, who's actually at the moment in central Queensland, sunning himself and having a swim out in the ocean. How are you going, Bronze?
Good, thanks. Beautiful. Yourself?
Couldn't be better. Now, you've got an event that's occurring on the 20th of January. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Well, we've got this pretty awesome event. We found this pretty cool meteorite crater just north of Dubbo, and so we've posted an event on the web there to get a few locals, and maybe a few people from further afield if they wish to come and join us. We've called it the Earth Shattering Kaboom, and I'm pretty sure millions of years ago when it had happened, it was probably an earth-shattering kaboom, so we're hoping the night will be a little bit quieter. But
now, tell us a little bit about the story behind finding this meteorite crater, because there was a bit of discussion on the forums.
Well, it's very interesting, actually. I was doing another cache called The View in the middle of Dubbo. It's in a biodiversity park, and there's a plaque in the middle of this council park that said there's a perched lake to the north of Dubbo. And I said, well, that's very strange, because Mix and I have been scouring this area for years looking for interesting places to go to, and I asked a few people over the following weekends when we were taking my Baja bug test driving, do you know anything about this perched lake? And interesting enough, not many people did. Geonad's heard that it may have been a meteorite crater, didn't know where it was, didn't know what it was called or anything like that. So anyway, as the weeks unfolded, I rang the council and they couldn't really tell me much other than how to get to it. So that weekend, a couple of weekends ago, I went for a drive out there and had a look. And one of the locals confirmed it was a meteorite crater, but in the 20 years he's been there, he's never visited it. So I went another 5Ks down the road past his place. And it's 140 hectares. It's oval in shape. It is circular, but if you look at it on Flash Earth or Google Earth, it's oval in shape. It's got quite a bit of non-European history attached to it. And it's quite an amazing spot. And it's quite surreal, because when you're in the crater itself, if it's windy outside, all the trees outside the crater are waving, but all the trees around the rim of the crater are dead still, and it's a little bit freaky.
Sounds like a pretty amazing place. Now, if people are going to come over to the event, what do they need to bring and what should they expect?
Well, I would suggest people should be pretty much self-supportive. Like, if they're, we initially only planned it as being just a picnic in the afternoon, and being summer, we thought, well, we'll make it a twilight picnic because it'll be a bit cooler in the afternoon. And then I was chatting on MSN with Cruising Around, and he suggested, well, I've got a telescope, why don't we just make it a picnic, twilight picnic, and if people want to, they can stay the night and we can use a telescope. And I thought, well, great, hey, what's the chances of a meteorite hitting in the same place twice? We'll be pretty safe there. So I would suggest that if people are coming, to bring their swags, bring whatever food they want, dip, biscuits, chairs. If they want to stay the afternoon, they can. If they want to stay the night, they can. It's running on the 20th of January, and we would suggest that people turn up around about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, bring their own gear, stories to tell. Depending on whether there's a fire ban on or not, we might have a campfire and we'll do up some dough bread and some twisties and damper for the kids.
And a billy of tea.
Yeah, billy tea, of course. Of course.
Now, do you need a four-wheel drive to get out there, or is it two-wheel drive accessible?
No, it's two-wheel drive. Two-wheel drive is all you need. The rim of the crater is about 5 metres higher than the surrounding crater, and there's a depression in the middle, mostly grass. It's nature reserve, so we're right to camp there. The council won't have any problems with it, and they don't even know where it is if they did. So, and I'm going to try and find out from the universities nearby a little bit more about the history of it.
All right. Well, sounds like a very enjoyable and maybe even educational experience. Thanks for joining us, Bronze.
Well, look, even ugly people can come along. So, Mix, if you're listening, come on out, big fella.
Thanks very much, Bronze.
See you, mate. See you.
Now, if you're an avid follower of the geocaching website or the Geocaching Australia forums, you're probably already aware of the Unite for Diabetes Travel Bug campaign. But even if you already have one in your letterbox, there's been a number of questions buzzing around about what is the purpose of the travel bug and what to do with it. So to answer those questions and many more, I'm joined on the line by Brian Roth, who's from Groundspeak in the United States. Welcome to GeoTalk, Brian. Can you start by telling us what is the Unite for Diabetes Travel Bug campaign all about?
Well, basically, the Unite for Diabetes Travel Bug promotion was designed for the purpose of spreading awareness on a global level of diabetes and the issues associated with diabetes. So what we did in working with the International Diabetes Federation as well as Merck was we created a series of 20,000 individual Unite for Diabetes travel bugs. And then we used a form on the website to allow people to request a travel bug to be sent to them. And no matter where they are in the world, we are going to send them one free of charge. You just fill out the form on unite.geocaching.com. And then each travel bug is named after a specific city in the world. And the goal is to be moved by the cacher that receives it into a cache closer to that city and for the travel bugs to gradually make their way to the destination city, spreading the diabetes awareness message along the way. And then once it reaches the specific city, it's supposed to circulate within the city and spread diabetes awareness within that location.
Now, I suppose the obvious question is, how does a travel bug spread awareness about diabetes as it moves from location to location?
Well, I think there's a number of ways that the promotion itself is spreading awareness. First of all, when people read about it on the website in different locations, they can they can go to unite.geocaching.com and obtain more information about the disease and about the promotion. And then when people find a travel bug that is branded with the Unite for Diabetes messaging and includes a link to the website, it's something that they can take notice and they can go to the internet and they can log that travel bug and read about the destination. You can read the logs and see photographs submitted by people who have found it. And you can also end up at the unite.geocaching.com website and in doing so learn more about the disease and about the promotion.
So it seems that the campaign is raising awareness of diabetes within the geocaching community, but is there anything that you want the geocaching community to do to raise awareness outside that group?
Not necessarily. I think that what they were counting on was the fact that geocachers, by nature, share their experiences with their friends and family, and they tell people about what they're doing. So if you go out geocaching and you have a great time, you're likely to go tell a friend or bring your family or your girlfriend or your boyfriend and take them out geocaching. So just by sharing the story of the promotion, that's one way. But another way, there were other aspects of the promotion that, for example, the uniteforDiabetes.org website has a prominent display of the geocaching promotion so that people who are not geocachers can come to the uniteforDiabetes.org website. They can go there and they can read about this promotion and either get involved in geocaching or just see another way that people around the world are working to spread diabetes awareness message.
Now, you just mentioned earlier that there are a number of cities in which these travel bugs are destined to arrive at. And I received mine this week, and mine's off to Guatemala, and I wish I could travel with it. But other people have discovered that theirs are off to Central Russia or Chad. How did you come up with the list of destinations for these travel bugs?
Basically, what we did was when we decided that it would be a global promotion, we figured that every city should potentially have an opportunity to be represented. And so what we did was we took a database of cities of the world, and we took we viewed them based on their population, and I believe that we took the top 20,000 populated cities in the world.
But one of the interesting things that many geocachers have already discovered is that the cities that their bug is traveling to doesn't have a cache in it, or in some cases the cache is hundreds if not thousands of kilometers away. How will these travel bugs get to these destinations, or are you not necessarily expecting them to get to that point, but as close as possible?
I think it's essentially twofold. You can certainly get it as close as possible. I mean, I don't think that we expect all 20,000 to ultimately reach their destination cities, but we're going to give it our best shot, of course, as a community. But just because there's no cash in the specific location does not mean that there can't be a cash placed in that location.
Now, I've noticed on the Unite for Diabetes Geocaching website that there's a competition that's being run each quarter. Can you tell me a little bit more about what that competition is?
Sure. In similar fashion to the Jeep geocaching promotion, there is a photo contest, and members of the geocaching community are supposed to submit photo logs of their experience with the Unite for Diabetes travel bugs. And every quarter, there's a new theme for the photographs, and those photos will be judged, and the winner, the best photograph that meets the goals for that quarter, this person that submitted that photograph will receive a GPS unit as a prize. And then at the end of the promotion next year, the best voted, the best chosen overall photograph will be framed and submitted to the United Nations on International Diabetes Day.
Now, one final question before I let you go. This is the first worldwide campaign that you've done through geocaching.com. Are there any plans to do any future ones, and will they involve awareness campaigns such as this one?
We don't have anything in the works. However, as with any promotion, we have our email lines open and our phone lines open, and if there is an organization or a company that is looking to do a unique promotion using geocaching, it's certainly something we would consider. From our perspective, it has to be something that we feel the geocaching community will appreciate. So, for example, the original Jeep promotion, it wasn't just about promoting the Jeep brand. It was about putting something out there that would be fun and enjoyable for the geocaching community. And in similar fashion, when we were approached by Merck and the International Diabetes Federation, one of the things that we really wanted to do was to produce an international promotion.
Well, Brian, thanks very much for taking out some time to talk to us, and I'm sure we'll all be following our travel bugs as they travel around the world raising awareness.
Great. I hope everybody enjoys the promotion and continues to enjoy geocaching.
Once again, it's time to delve into the geocaching mailbag. First cab off the rank, as I promised a few episodes ago, a big congratulations to Emby and his wife on the birth of their brand new daughter. All are doing well, and you can check out the pictures and the stories on the Geocaching Australia forum website. Many of you in Australia would have known about the Victorian bushfires throughout December, and I spoke to Rhino Geo, who's put together a series of maps to show where the fires have occurred and which caches they may have affected. So check that out, I'll give you a link in the show notes. And finally, thank you to Sox from Sydney and Jack, who was listening to the podcast in Singapore while he was away. Thank you for the kind emails. Now, don't forget, if you want to get an email read out on GeoTalk, whether it's a milestone, a cheerio, a hooroo, wherever you are from Australia, drop us an email at geotalk@mac.com. Now, before we finish up GeoTalk again for another fortnight, let's give you the answer to the quiz question. And that was, which cache in Australia was logged the most times according to the Geocaching Australia website in 2006? Well, let's start state by state from the bottom. Coming in 8th spot was the Northern Territory with Court Pot with 34 fines. In 7th spot was Tasmania with Every Player Wins a Prize with 36 fines. In 6th spot was Commonwealth Creek from the ACT with 60 fines. In 5th spot was WA with King Park Travel Bug Hotel with 67 fines. In 4th spot was Victoria, surprisingly, with South Bank and 70 fines. In 3rd spot was South Australia with King's Cross, 74 fines. Narrowly just missing out from Queensland in 2nd spot with Smithy and 76 fines. So that leaves New South Wales the winner with Tolkien Tree, 106 fines. So that's the answer to the quiz question. And just for a little bit of extra trivia, for those of geocachers across the ditch over in New Zealand, The North Island of New Zealand has Kaiuru Thermal Travel Bug Hotel in Rotorua with 92 fines. So that would put it in about second spot if we counted as Australasia. And one last thing before I go, apologies for the sound quality. My equipment has been playing up a little bit in the last few days, but fortunately I was able to stick it together with a bit of sticky tape and blue tack and get it all out in time for you this fortnight. Hopefully within the next few weeks we'll get everything sorted. In next episode of GeoTalk, you're going to hear some fairly funny commentary of me trying to find a 1.5-star terrain geocache and why it took me more than an hour to find. And you'll also hear the launch of a podcache in New South Wales. That's some fairly exciting stuff. So until next time, safe geocaching.